study picks up again in our Revelation, the 11th chapter. And Sister Molly, would you read for us in the 11th chapter, verses 7 through 12, please?
Revelation 11, 7 through 12. Now when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. Their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days, men from every people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. The inhabitants of the earth will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts, because these two prophets had tormented those who live on the earth. But after the 3.5 days, a breath of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and terror struck those who saw them. Then they heard a loud voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." And they went up to heaven in a cloud while their enemies looked on.
And actually, please finish out with verse 13, sorry. Mm-hmm.
At that very hour, there was a severe earthquake, and a tenth of the city collapsed. 7,000 people were killed in the earthquake, and the survivors were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So, brethren, the only correction we really want to make is in verse 13, and the King James has it wrong too. It uses the word "same hour," and the word "same" is not there. It's and that hour is better in the Greek, and that hour. So I'd make that observation. Ruth.
Before we get started, it's just a fun fact. This is our 100th study in Revelation.
Oh.
Today.
Very nice. Well, this chapter 11 is halfway through the book of Revelation. So it's a point of interest. Okay. But I have to say, I think we've laid as we all know, we've laid a lot of groundwork in the opening chapters that will benefit us and hopefully make things easier as we go along. Okay. With this, we've talked about initially two views. We broadened it out to three views of how to interpret these verses, including the earlier verses of verse three about the 1260 years of the two witnesses prophesying in sackcloth. And we've had a lot of discussion, and it's all been profitable. And as we keep saying, it's that it's okay. All the views, these three views anyway, that have been discussed at some level, none of them are in conflict with truth or present truth. None of them are in conflict with the divine plan of the ages. They are legitimate differences of opinion, of interpretation. And that is perfectly fine. We are talking about symbolic language, which already is a challenge to interpret, because it's symbol. That's the point. And, so none of the views are in conflict with present truth. So, with that being said, we've also, stated that for some, this is exposure and understanding, and there is a connection to the 17th chapter about the beasts ascending out of the bottomless pit, that we want to have a certain consistency, whatever you and I each think. We want to have some consistency with that expression, that beast in Revelation 17. And we haven't gotten there. We did spend some time there, but we haven't gotten there in our study. So again, it's part of setting something on the shelf. And so that being said, I'm going to go through these verses in a condensed manner, things that all have been said, over the past few weeks. And then we will allow for any other expressions that the friends would like to make. And then we'll move along in the study. My particular perspective is that this 1260 years of being clothed in sackcloth, prophesying, would be approximately the late 200s or 300 AD, as it were, down into the time of the Great Reformation in the 1500s. That it's this 1260 year period specifically has to do with the Old and New Testament being set aside by use of the people in general, first being replaced by church dogma and church councils, starting in 325 AD, and that when Jerome translated the Old and New Testament into Latin, which was called, that Bible was called the Vulgate, became, as it were, a dead language to the people in general, and remained so until the Great Reformation and during the 1500s, after the advent of the printing press. We had over 23 different languages having the Old and New Testament in their own language, and that most of those, if not all, those languages, they used a better Greek and Hebrew and not the Vulgate for their translation, which, of course, is an important point. And that even the Roman Catholic Church, by, 1562, I believe, they came out with their own English Old and New Testaments, the Reims Douay version, even though they also came out with a new printing of the Vulgate saying that Latin was still the preferred language. But nonetheless, that's a view that I particularly would prefer myself, and that they finished their testimony. I like the thought that Brother Frank Chaloux presents that would have been in 1526, and the 3.5 years of their dead bodies lying in the street of the great city, what would have been the public burnings of the Bible by the papists, particularly in England, but it was throughout the continent, until the last public burning of specifically purchased Bibles for that burning took place in 1530. And it wasn't that there still wasn't persecution of the Bible, but it did start to be replaced because the people were loving having their Bibles in their own languages. And even the King of England ends up approving a Bible for the churches, known as the Chain Bible, and then later more Bibles, you know, tape force, as it were, eventuating in the great King James Bible of 1611. But the ones who were persecuting or killed the Bible toward that end of that, after that 1260 year period ending in the Great Reformation, was the papacy. That's the beast. And that beast shall ascend out of the pit in the future. And that's in the 17th chapter. So it was a papacy that was making war on the Bible. Then the people of earth who were rejoicing were those who were Roman Catholics, and they didn't like these new translations in the common language. They were happy with what the church clergy were telling them when they went to church. And they were happy with their masses and their rosaries and lighting candles, and that was the Roman Catholic part. That was the people of earth who were rejoicing. And then what took place is that after 1530, after that 3.5 year very specific period of their dead bodies being exposed to shame and ridicule, laying in the streets, as it were, the Spirit of God has entered into them, and they stood upon their feet. And this demonstrates that the Old and New Testament, these two witnesses, after that 3.5 year period of that public burnings and whatnot, they actually gained greater popularity. Like we said, even eventually the Roman Catholic Church printed a Bible, Old and New Testaments in English and so on. So, the papacy had to give way to the common demands for the Bible and the people's language, which they did reluctantly. They put their own notes in the margins, as we talked about. And there was the great fear, upon them which saw them, which showed that the papacy had to capitulate. And there is a point, in history, in the latter 1500s, it's called the Counter-Reformation. We know about the Great Reformation. That's our focus. The Counter-Reformation was actually a reformation within the Roman Catholic Church because, the abuses had been so, bad and then so exposed by Protestants and others, showing the problems like Martin Luther with the, indulgences and various things. And the corruption had been so bad in the papacy that even within the church, there were cries for reform. So there was this counter-reformation in the latter part of the 1500s, just shows the effects of the Bible in the common language and the Reformation taking place and the advent and progress of Protestantism from that time. Then in verse 12, with the view that I favor, there's a process of a couple hundred years bringing you to a time where the Old and New Testaments were greatly exalted in the Bible societies of the early 1800s, particularly 1804 starts it with the British and foreign Bible societies, and others followed thereafter in other countries. But this was a grand exaltation. So to my mind, verses 11 and 12 show a process. And then that takes us to our verse 13. And that hour, there was a great earthquake, 10th part of the city fell. That would be the French Revolution. And that hour was the hour in that time period where the French Revolution was taking place. And shortly thereafter was this great exaltation of the Bible in the Bible societies starting 1804. We remember the French Revolution was 1789 to 1799. And so that, I think I'll just hold up there, that was the 10th part of the city. That city is Christendom. It was France that was the strongest supporter of papacy at that point in time. And then that takes us back to our verse 8. Their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city. This refers to, of course, Christendom. And, of which, we have the continental part of Christendom but it included, the British Isles at that time before Henry VIII broke away. And so that was the great city, included the whole city, not just a 10th part of the city where the bodies lay dead. And in the Sodom and Egypt showed the corruptive and the worldly element of, Christendom. Okay, so that being said, I'm trying to say a few words. I did take a little bit here, trying not, because we've discussed it so much. I'm, like I said, just trying to keep it short, but I'd be happy to entertain other presentations on this same spread of verses or any comments or questions. Or we could just say, all right, well, fair enough. We've got the info. We'll think on it, and let's just proceed. Okay, that's what we'll do. So in our verse 13, I think the brethren are all agreed, no matter what view they like, that this great earthquake of the 10th part of the city falling was the French Revolution. And in the earthquake, were slain of men 7,000. And when you look over in the margin of at least the Oxford King James, it has, were slain the names of men, 7,000. So any comments on that? Brother Chris and Brother Dan.
This would be Well, 7,000, we get that number typically means it's approved of the Lord. So it was upon his timetable, 7, giving us divine overruling. And the names of men, that's exactly what the French Revolution was all about, bringing down all these titles and nobility that was oppressing the people so bad, as well as, and it was religious and civil, it was across the board. So it was really a micro picture of anarchy and the destabilization of the status quo. I think the comments book brings that out as well. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Brother Chris. I appreciate that. Brother Dan.
Yeah, same thought, that 7,000 represents the titles of nobility that were removed, destroyed in the process of the French Revolution. So I have in my margin bishop, duke, and so on. All of these titles of these elite ones were no longer. Over.
Okay. Very good. Further comments on that. We know, Brother David.
Just, Brother Rick, the same kind of idea, but in an idea of the Nicolaitans, those that lorded it over the people, in place of God's spiritual truth, Jesus and his messengers, the word of the prophets, and so on and so forth. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. Appreciate that. Any other comments on this? Let's take a breath and let's ask, make a couple of connections here. Where else in the Revelation is the French Revolution depicted or symbolized? Where else in the Book of Revelation is the French Revolution depicted? Brother James.
That be chapter 9, verse 15, in that area with the, or verse 13, the sixth angel sounding his trumpet. I was looking at verse 15, and the four angels who had been kept ready for this very hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind.
Well, quite often we have that as Luther trumpeting.
Okay.
At 1517, and the start of the Reformation, and the effects of the Reformation, but it's true, the French Revolution is, of course, during this sixth trumpet period. But did you have more on that, Brother James?
Well, maybe the reference is just to the symbolic meaning of killing.
Okay.
Over.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Let's see, Brother Chris and then Ruth.
Well, first place I'd look is in the seals, which would correspond to the trumpets from a different perspective, but that would be chapter 6, verse 12, where it speaks of a great earthquake and the sun became black as sackcloth and hair and the moon became as blood. I think that's a reference to the French Revolution.
Oh, that's good. Why don't you keep reading for us? Because that's true. We did study this through, but why don't you read, through,
Okay. So verse 13, and the stars of heaven fell onto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. And the heaven departed as a scroll when it rolled together, and every mountain and island were removed out of their places. And the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the rich men, and the chief captains, and the mighty men, and every bondman, and every free man, hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains. and said, go to the mountains, and said to the mountains and the rocks, fall over us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of his wrath is come, and who shall be able to stand? So again, a bunch of symbolic language, but we know the heavens all refer to the ecclesiastical powers that be, and the earth represents the earthly phase, the civil typically, or religious masses under religious restraint. And then we see the falls of these kings and great men and chiefs. So these are the names, just like we're reading here in chapter 11. These titles just went right out the window. So we get two judgment messages from two different chapters of Revelation. Two witnesses telling us the same story, but a little bit different. This is chapter 6, much more detailed to fill in, and then chapter 11 just kind of giving us enough information to harken back to what he's already taught us about that time period. Over.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that. Thank you. Ruth, did you have something you wanted to add?
No, I'm just going to bring up the same passage.
Do you have anything to add on there while we read them, after Brother Chris read them?
I was thinking of that verse 15, and the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and every free man hid themselves. I was thinking of the 7,000, kind of like the same class, that they, all the people that were somebody before suddenly don't want to be anybody.
Yeah, very good.
They renounced their titles because it made them a target.
Okay. Right on. Thank you. Brother Godwin.
Thank you, Brother Rick. So going through my notes, I see in Revelation 12, the 12th chapter, verse 15, that says, and the serpent cast out of his mouth water as flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away off the flood. So here the flood reference again to French Revolution.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. We really appreciate that. That's a likewise another good example of that. Okay, good. Sister Cheryl?
I was going to bring out Revelation 12:15 also. Thank you.
Do you have anything to add? In that verse?
I don't know, but you can see, just that you can see the relation of, you know, the beast making war, and but yet the Lord helps them to stand up in verse 16. Over.
Okay, now that's very good. That's very good. Brother Godwin, did you have a follow-up?
No, sorry, I've got to lower my hand.
Okay, very good. Sister Debbie.
I was looking at Revelation 16:18.
Okay.
And that's another great earthquake. It was the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air. So it makes me wonder again if these the plagues and the, you know, seals and stuff might not be, well, this is the seventh vial, so I don't know.
Since you're there,
okay,
in Revelation 16:18, why don't you read that verse for us?
And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great.
So what's different between this earthquake we read about and the earthquake of the French Revolution? What's different?
That this was not since men upon, you know, such as was not since men were upon the earth. So I guess that would be way bigger than just one revolution in one country.
Yeah. Which also, though, helps us understand that, as Brother Russell brings out from these scriptures, that the French Revolution, the fall of one tenth of the city is a illustration of what's going to take place in the future when we have the whole city fall. It's going to be the greatest revolution that has ever been. So, okay. So what we see in the French Revolution is a precursor to what we will see in the future. All right. Thank you. Sister Debbie, is that a follow up?
Yeah. I was thinking also of, like the Lord, when he talked about a lot of things like Matthew 28:2, he also brought up there, well, there's other great earthquakes. Okay. Not 28:2, but I think it might have been Luke 21:11, was it maybe, where the Lord talked about earthquakes.
Yeah.
11. Would he have, yeah, and great earthquakes shall be in diverse places and famines and pestilences. Is this, could he have been prophesying about, you know, what was in Revelations too? You know, sure. As far as all of that.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true.
Okay.
Jesus was the greatest prophet. Okay, good. So, we'll leave it there. The friends have brought out good examples of how the French Revolution has been previously depicted in the sixth trumpet that we covered, even though it's talking about the same time period. And then how in Revelation 12, what we read there is that this flood comes forth at the conclusion or toward the end of that 1260 years of the woman, the church, being in the wilderness condition. So that helps us also with our timing, that we're recognizing that flood in Revelation 12 as a cause for the French Revolution. So that's a flood. That's water out of the dragon's mouth. So it was truth, but they were being applied for the purpose of trying to lead to the persecution of the true church. And that was the truth, as we often say, the writings of Voltaire and Rousseau and others about the rights of man, which did bring about the French Revolution. And yet the earth drank up those waters. The people of France, who had been under religious restraint, accepted these writings about the rights of man, and they quaked. They earthquaked. They reacted in a social revolution and threw off the papacy and the aristocracy. Not what Satan wanted, not what the dragon wanted, but that was the result. So Satan worked hard, and he got the Antichrist, the papacy, reinstalled by Napoleon, who needed it for his purpose of being crowned emperor of the Roman Empire in his mind. Okay. Sister Debbie.
Okay, so is that what they mean by, what the scripture means by, the remnant were affrighted and gave glory to God, to the God of heaven? That's not the real God, but, papacy and reinstating papacy. Is that what that one was about?
That's a very reasonable way to understand that. I wanted to take a moment. This was a past study that I brought up. I wanted to just share a few things about what was at that time taking, you know, how the stage was set in France for this French Revolution. I'm going to read a little bit to you. Some of this, I'm going to rattle off some numbers if you're a note taker for a list that, you know, just want to give you a heads up that I'm going to do some of that. This isn't like super important to try to remember. It just helps with some of the flavor. I found it helpful in the past. And, so in France at the time, of the revolution prior to the revolution, there were what's called three estates. The first estate, second estate, and the third estate. And what was known as the first estate, was the church, which was the papacy in France, and her clergy. And now here's some numbers. There were 23,000 monks. This is in France. 60,000 curates and vicars. 37,000 nuns. 2,500 monasteries. 1,500 convents. 60,000 churches and chapels. And in all, it's estimated 130,000 persons were of the ordained members of the Roman Catholic Church. That was the first estate. Now, in the first estate, there consisted of a higher and a lower element. The higher element would have been the Pope, cardinals, archbishops, and that was about 10% of that 130,000. And many of those actually were from families of nobility. That 10% also, they mainly resided in the popular cities like Paris and Versailles, and they engaged in all the entertainments of city life. And these were also quite often advisors to the kings and the king's courtiers. So they were instrumental in helping shape policy. Now the state, which is representative of the second estate, they really gave a virtual monopoly over the state to the papacy or religion, so that the church controlled education, marriage, funerals, and humanitarian assistance to the poor. Now, when I'm reading all this, I did this study was an assignment some years ago to show the relationship of what took place in revolutionary France and the setting that would help us identify the precursors and setting for that greatest earthquake that's yet future when the whole city falls. So when I put this together, we were doing it for the purpose of helping illustrate what to look forward to on a larger scale in the future. The first estate owned about 15% of the French lands, and most of that was of the best land. And those lands were tax exempt. Yet, the first estate demanded and received rent from the tens of thousands of tenant farmers that lived on their land. So let me break that down. The church owns 15% of the best lands of France. Then they get it tax exempt. They don't have to pay the state or government anything, but they're charging all the tenant farmers. These farmers couldn't own the land. The first estate owned the land. So they rent the land for a fee for the farmers to raise their crops. And out of that, the farmers have to pay a rent to, the papacy or the first estate. Besides that, the church also demanded a tithe of about 10% of all the peasants' earnings. Yet, that being said about the first estate, the majority were of a lower birth and background. They were not of nobility, and they actually didn't live in the big cities. These were those living out in the villages, and they were often considered fondly by the villages and the peasantry, because this lower class of the first estate, priests and nuns and monks, they identified more with the people in the villages. So they weren't as corrupted. They weren't viewed as being as corrupted as those of that dwelt in the larger cities. So I'm going to skip down some of the things here. the clergy was not called upon to serve in the military. The clergy could not be tried in civil courts. Although most French remained believers in God and church, they were increasingly suspect of the higher clergy as being more interested in their own well-being than that of the people or even God. In fact, when the French Revolution took place, they had what's called the National Assembly. And 149 of these lower priests and monks were signed on to the National Assembly, showing that they had a sympathy with the people. But we moved to the second estate, which was the nobility. That was about 140,000 people. But then you have the third estate. That's the commoners. That's about 26 million. So the first and second estates, owned 3/5 of all the best land of France. The third estate, that 26 million of the commoners, only owned the remaining 2/5 of the land. So in summary, the essence of French life was that the state taught men what to do, the church taught men what to believe, and as for man, his business was to be governed. So, in saying all of that, I guess in my mind, I simply make the switch out from the first and second and third estates just to, in my mind, I think of the 1% versus the remainders. And so we can see that the odds have gotten a lot worse and the disparity much greater. And the vast majority of wealth held by the 1% and everything that goes with that wealth far exceeds that of what the vast majority of the remaining 99% have. And you and I are very familiar with all of that. We read about it in the news on a regular basis. I'm going to jump in with another seemingly unrelated little blurb. You might have noticed that just within the last week or so, the Supreme Court, among other things that they passed that in Maine, the state of Maine, that the state of Maine had to provide taxpayer money to fund several religious schools in the state of Maine. Now, it used to be the separation of church and state forbade a state from collecting taxes and then using part of those taxes to fund religious orientated schools. They were to be used for public schools, which were secular. But here they just crossed that line. It's the same number of votes with the justices, the 3 who are considered liberal versus the others who aren't. So the point is that that was another change of seeing religion being considered by this conservative element of justices as being something that the government can be involved in supporting. So I'm going to leave it there. I know that could generate a whole nother slew of comments, and I understand that. But I just brought that out as just another little indicator of how we are heading toward the similar direction of what the world was like in France that led to the French Revolution. The abuse of clergy, we don't have to even, you know, we're all so familiar with that. Even in the Protestant churches, this new great report that came out more like 3 weeks ago about the Southern Baptist group of churches, that's the largest Protestant church in the United States, being, unfortunately, they too had their own clergy sexual misconduct covered up by higher ups in the Southern Baptist assemblies for years. And the poor women and others who were abused, when they tried to present their, you know, their case to their church leaders, they were all shut down and ignored. So it's just again, demonstrating how Babylon has become the hold of every unclean fowl. That includes the, you know, the Protestants are being exposed as well as the Papists. Again, just another indicator of what was taking place at, in pre-revolutionary France is what's building in our day. Any comments on any of this that I was just talking about? Bernadette and Brother David.
Just a quick question, because I couldn't keep up. When you were bringing out the three estates, the first estate taught men what to do, and then I didn't catch what the second and third estate, what the line was.
So I'll word it another way. The first estate taught men what to believe.
What to believe.
The second estate taught men what to do. And the third estate, it was their business to be governed.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Brother David.
Brother Rick, that also struck me when I saw that on the news this week, just thinking that was a real checking of a virtual box for things happening. And then right behind it, we have this, although it's a volatile issue for the United States, we have the gun laws, which were overthrown in New York. And then at the same time, there were laws passed in a lawful way by both members of Congress and the voice of the president issuing that in. And then we had this abortion issue, which again is the Supreme Court of our land, which basically upheld the rule of law in our land, making a random decision over precedent and just wiping out precedent for a mutual agreed outcome. And this has been taking place for quite a while. We also have the one percenters that control the 1% of the population controls most of the wealth. So these same things are prevalent today and really mark the time quite well for what we can expect, hopefully in a short time. That's just, I'm just going over the stuff we all know. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Brother David. So true. Thank you. Brother Mark in Jerusalem.
Yes, hello. when we were studying this one time, they divided the three estates as clergy, aristocracy, in the guilds, not Bill and Estelle, but these were the ones that had the talents, like your lawyers and your carpentry and masons and things like that, who ended up.
Oh, sorry. We lost you at they ended up. Brother Mark, we're not hearing you now. Still not hearing you. Now I hear you.
Okay. So it was the clergy was group one. The aristocracy was the second estate. And the third estate were the guilds, the ones that ended up being responsible for generating the money. And the only ones that paid into this was the third group. The first two groups were exempt. And that's why when it came to the French Revolution, the church went to the guillotine first, and then the aristocracy went to the guillotine, and group three were like supervising this overturning because they saw all the money going from their pocket into maintaining the whole government. But I don't know if that agrees with how you were looking at it or not, but over.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Brother Mark. That's good. And yes, the guilds played an important role in the business factor. And I just took the Third Estate as being basically the remainder. Some of you might remember from the hippie days, the Fourth Estate. That was an expression about the liberation of the people who aren't part of the capitalistic society. That was the Fourth Estate. Anyway, I digress. Ruth, please.
I was struck by the similarity of not paying taxes, that the wealthy and the religious organizations don't pay taxes, and all the taxes are leveled on the lower classes, seems to me anyway. It was kind of a funny story when Jeff Bezos, one of the wealthiest men in the world, went to space. There was a petition going around not to let him come back. And you could see that the general population is so angry with the wealthy, and they get all the benefits and they get the tax cuts and all that. So it just showed their attitude. Over.
Yeah, so true. He came back and he thanked all the workers, Amazon, that made it possible for them to accomplish that. And all the workers are saying, well, why don't you just give us a raise, a nice big raise? And it kind of, we know it fell on deaf ears, but all that being said, it's so true. There's a lot of easily found on the internet, easily found groups who monitor the wealth of the wealthiest and how much tax they end up paying, as well as corporation tax that's paid and how little they actually pay in percentage. When they pay at all. So, and the church, as you said, in America, it's tax free. So just a lot of, building resentment and continues to build. Very good. Any other comments on any of the preceding? Okay. Brother Dan?
Well, I don't know if this is, has an answer or going off subject, but when you mentioned that along with the paying the tax, the common people paying the tax on the land or renting the land so that they could survive and grow food, they also had to pay 10% tithe, if you will. Do you see anything in connection with the future church state union and control over the people with any kind of what's the word I'm looking for, mandated support of the church and state system? Over.
No, thank you, Brother Dan. Two quick comments. One is that in recent years, we've seen more and more that tax dollars collected by the United States government has been doled out to various religious church systems for them to distribute in a humanitarian way. And that was a change. It used to be you could not take tax dollars collected from the populace and give it to churches to distribute. But that has changed in more recent times. And part of the thinking was that the churches have a distribution network in place. So they've received funds. At the time, it was highlighted as this is a big change and a big deal, but we've grown used to it now. So the general public here just think of it more as, well, they're doing a good thing. So let's let it be. But the other thing, Brother Dan, is I would suspect that is a possible part of having to receive the mark of the beast in the future will be participating in funding to these churches in some manner. Not the whole of it, not by any means, but a part of it. It could easily be part of the mark in the hand, willing to cooperate through support, rather than the mark in the forehead, which is an intellectual agreement with the teachings. But that's yet to be seen. Time will tell. This may be an element thereof. Brother David?
Brother Rick, I'm sure everybody remembers, too, that in Europe they have a tax for the support of the infrastructure of the churches, which we saw, what was it, Notre Dame burn. But like, for instance, the Church of Cologne, that's supported by the public with a public tax that's just levied upon the public because there's not enough people attending the churches to take care of the infrastructure anymore. Just a point. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Brother David. Appreciate that. Brother Michael.
I'm just trying to tie it all back to what we are reading. The events that we are seeing right now in terms of how the church, again, I guess I'm struggling a little bit to just try to understand how the earth helped her by opening up its mouth and swallowing the river. You know, so I understand the estates that you've come up with. Thank you for really sharing. I mean, that's a different perspective that I've not really seen before. But again, just trying to tie back to, you know, how the earth was able to help, you know, the woman.
Okay. No, that's good. Good question. So in that Revelation 12, on verses, particularly verse 15 through 17. And Brother Michael, would you like to read that, please?
Sure. 15. I'm reading the NASB. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. For the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of its mouth. So the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus.
Okay, good. Thank you. Now, I do have a note here, and many of you, I'm sure, do, is that Brother Russell gives some detail on his interpretation of these verses in the third volume on page 65 and 66. And that's generally where I think the brethren have come to think of this. There is a correlation to Daniel, the 12th chapter, about the man standing on the two sides of the river. But that being said, we'll leave that there. Each of us might have references in Daniel 12 that would also be to the French Revolution, the time of the end, at 1799. But here, let's focus on this. Who would like to give us an overview of these verses, particularly 15 and 16? Sister Cheryl, why don't you go ahead and start us?
Well, I'll read you my notes. I have truth due to be understood after the French Revolution. Satan hoped the authorities would take charge. So that was the backing of it. And this flood that came out, he was just hoping that the leaders of that time would take charge of what was going on because he saw things falling apart. Over.
Okay. Appreciate it. Good. Thank you. Who would like to contribute? Ruth.
Well, I was looking back at 11. As the writer and gave glory to the God of heaven, and that's kind of what Satan wanted. He wanted people to be terrified of the liberties that were being released and the truths of the rights of man and things that were showing that it created this revolution, and he wanted them to go back and hug their chains, so to speak. He wanted them to go back and get under religious restraint of the papacy again because they were terrified of seeing what was coming on the earth. But in reality, the earth liked it. They liked to understand about their rights and their liberties from the terrible abuses of papacy and the concept of democracy and free speech and things like that. So they really liked it, but that's not what Satan intended. Over.
All right, good. You're combining the two, 11th chapter reading and this 12th chapter reading. Brother Chris, you had your hand up. Anything on that?
I think Ruth covered it pretty good. You know, all these atheist writers, the rights of the individual, and, that it was intended to just crush all the church, anyone claiming to be a Christian would, especially devout Christians, they would have to go out with the papacy. I mean, all of it would be hated. And again, Satan could work through the governments, or as Sister Ruth was bringing out, they would be so fearful of it, they'd run back to the papacy. You know, it'd be fine too, as long as they're controlled by me. But these liberties, they received them, they enjoyed them, and it's like, well, we can believe whatever we want. We have individual freedoms. And so those that were devout Christians or whatever, the disparity was tolerated and accepted ultimately, and papacy had to make its modifications and adjustments. And as brought out already said, Satan wasn't very pleased with that outcome at all. So he had to rework it, and he did find a way in. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. Thank you. Ruth.
Plus, they were also being inspired by what was going on in America at the time with the American Revolution, and they're throwing off the chains of the British and having their own democracy and their own freedoms and the Constitution and all that. And so that was inspiring them to follow that example. And Satan didn't like that either. He was trying to squelch the American Revolution too. Over.
So they're two different things. Satan's casting out of floodwaters resulted in the French Revolution. That's not actually what he was hoping for, because it says the earth drank in the waters. That's not what he was hoping for. And the American Revolution, which actually preceded it, Satan hated that. He wasn't the cause of it, but he hated that because it allowed freedom of liberty and separation between church and state. And he needs church and state to work together to persecute those who don't believe his false religions. Okay, good. Brother Chris.
I was just going to bring out that the Bill of Rights in America was 1789, the very year that the French Revolution began. So connecting to Sister Ruth's comment that they were looking what was going on overseas. And Benjamin Franklin was the American ambassador to France. He loved it. he went as often as he could. He loved being in France. So he was very influential with what was going on over there. I don't think he was trying to spur on a revolution, but just a little background information. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. So as Brother Gene Burns once put, the Satan's putting forth truths never works well for him. So the flood of waters that came out regarding the rights of man did not bring about the hope for reaction of the people to want to turn away from these new radical views and go back into the arms more fully of church and state. But rather the people, the earth, drank in these radical views and spewed off instead church and state. However, as we read in chapter 11, Ruth was making the connection. Chapter 11, verse 13. And the remnant were affrighted and gave glory to the God of heaven. This is a counterfeit. This is the Pope and papacy. What happened after the French Revolution with Napoleon and the others, the church was reinstituted and the office of the Inquisition was reinstalled by Napoleon, believe it or not, and that the Napoleon had the Pope present. He didn't allow the Pope to crown him, but he had the Pope present while he himself was coronated as the emperor. So, okay. Brother Michael, we hope that's useful information. And again, probably in that third volume, page 65, 66 is probably the best.
Got it. Thank you. But just to go back to chapter 11 then. So the 7,000 there, who are they? I'm not sure if it was definitively answered or if there were thoughts as to who the 7,000 could really represent.
Well, no, that's good. And in the Oxford margin, Oxford Bible margin, it says it's 7,000 names of men, or some translation has it as titles of men. And so the suggestion is that in the great earthquake in France, that 10th part of the city, when it fell, so fell the aristocracy. And these kings, these great men that we had read about in Revelation, the 6th chapter, during the 6th seal, our same time period, they went to hide in caves because of the great earthquake. So their prestigious titles were lost sight of during that period of time. And then the remnant were affrighted that after that French Revolution, rather immediately, we have the return to papacy in France. In fact, before the French Revolution was actually even fully over, they reopened the churches, as we talked about last week. And they let priests out of prison with certain restraints. And then, like we said, the papacy was reinstalled in their positions of power. So that was kind of the thinking on that. Brother Chris and Sister Day.
Yeah, we typically say that in Revelation, when we see a number, it's the book of Revelation is symbolic. Almost everything has some kind of symbolic or figurative picture or type associated with it, but the numbers we look at as literal. And when we read here of men 7,000, we also know that the number 7 is a symbolic number. Yeah, whether 770, 700, 7,000. So we can think of the number 7 and the number 10 as having a representation of symbology. If there's a literal application to it, you kind of hit it when you were going through the various estates of France and other places in Revelation. All of these all of these titles, it might be possible to scratch out 7,000 literal titles that were disrupted or eliminated or harmed during this revelation. There may be an actual literal application for that 7,000. It would be quite a study to try to figure that out. But nevertheless, that, like I was trying to say earlier, is that that 7,000, when we see the number 7, it typically represents God's judgment or God's timing or God's approval, that this is the time for those wheels of the earth that we talk about in Ezekiel are now raised off the ground because he's moving his plan forward. Sometimes those wheels within wheels are rolling on the earth and it has an earthly application. So I try to keep all of them studies connected and see the continuity between them all. Over.
Yes, it's playing 3D chess, and it's a challenge, but it's very rewarding when you get to make a good move. Thank you. Very good. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, along with that, with what Brother Rick said, it wasn't just aristocracy that was knocked down. It was priestcraft too. A lot of religious titles were, in a sense, knocked down in France at the time. So you can add nobility plus the religious titles. Plus, wasn't there something about the there was a general of a state or something? You know, there was governmental titles as well as nobility and religious titles. There were governmental titles and, you know, policemen and stuff like that. The different agencies of the second estate that took advantage of the third estate. Over.
All right. Very good. Thank you. And as brought out in that Revelation 6, we have all these ones that were affected. And fled into the caves, for hiding. Okay. No, that's all good. Appreciate it. Any other comments here on the verses discussed so far today? Danny Kay was the inspector general.
That's a reference to a movie classic from the 50s.
Oh. All right, very good. Okay. Four-dimensional chess. I didn't keep up with that one. All right. Brother David.
Just a comment on James 5 as far as the false confidence that the elite and the aristocracy and the clergy held with the confidence of money, which they basically stole from the poor. And the Lord has made plenty of provision in his word for the poor. We have the gleanings and so on and so forth and the jubilees and where things would be restored. But the Lord will hold them all accountable. As pointed out in James 5. Over.
Okay, no, very good. Appreciate it. That's so true. It relates very well. Okay. If we took, to emphasize Brother Mark Candle's comment on the definition of the three estates, which is very good, I broadened out the third one. Limited it to the guilds, the business class, the money makers in that way, which is good. No argument. In Revelation 18, we take a quick look there. Again, we've discussed this over the years. We spent a lot of time here when we studied Ezekiel. Hold on. Let me get the right book. I'm going to. It'll irritate me if I say it wrong. Sorry. Bear with me for a second. Oh, there we are. When we studied Ezekiel 27 and Ezekiel 28, don't go back there, but when we studied there about the fall of Tyre and its connections and how there were two destructions, one earlier by Nebuchadnezzar and one later by the Greek Alexander the Great. We made a connection because in Ezekiel 28, it talked when Tyre fell, there were the merchants very predominantly. And in our Revelation 18, you and I know that we have in verses, verses 2 and 3, we've got Babylon become the hold of every foul spirit, cage of every unclean, hateful bird. All the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants, I'm in verse 3, of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. So we have, as it were, the first estate, the harlot, the great city papacy, and Protestantism, religion. The second estate, the kings of the earth, the governmental powers. And the third estate, the merchants, those who are the big money producers. And all three cooperate together to sustain the final church-state government of the future. And yet all three fall, and they fall in the order of the woman, the religious element of Christendom, then the kings that are far off, the governments, and then the merchants. And when it gets to the merchants, it talks about how they have benefited through traffic. And then when you get down to the merchants, it goes on, and it down in verse, seventeen. For in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster, all the company and ships, sailors, as many as trade by sea, stood afar off and cried when they saw that great city fall. So the point is that, like when we read back and studied in Ezekiel 27 and 28, we were seeing the comparisons of how the entire economy, starting with the merchants, the wealthiest, but trailing all the way down, even to the common people who benefit by economic trade, they all suffer when they see this final attempt to keep order in that church-state government of the future collapse. And that leads into the great earthquake that we read about, the greatest earthquake, and then it dissolves into the fire of anarchy to remove the last vestiges of this old heavens and this old earth. So anyway, maybe a few extra connections that we weren't counting on, but that seems to fit well with these three estates concept and their final removal. The religious harlots, the kings of the earth, and then the merchants, and the trickle down to everyone who benefits from the economy. Does that generate any comments? Okay. All right. Well, then turning back to our study proper, the 11th chapter. Does anyone have anything more on verse 13 they'd like to bring out? All right. Sister Roseanne, can you read verse 14 for us, please?
The second woe is past. Behold, the third woe is coming. And that's a transition statement. We're leaving one, going to another woe. I'm not sure what else to say about that.
Do you have any cross references there, or do you remember where these woes were first introduced? These three woes were first introduced to us.
Yes. The fifth trumpet was the first woe. And the sixth trumpet was the second woe, is what I wrote. So now we're going into the third woe.
Yep. And what's that going to be?
That's going to be... Ooh. Wait.
What's our next verse start with?
It starts with, oh, then the seventh angel sounded, and there was a loud voice in heaven saying, the kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of the Lord and his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. Yeah, beautiful.
Okay. Very good. So this is, there's only three woes. And as Sister Roseanne brought out, it's the first was the fifth trumpet with Brother Wycliffe. The second woe was Martin Luther, Brother Martin Luther, the sixth trumpet. And now we're going into our third woe, the last woe, which is the seventh trumpet sounded by Brother Russell. And there is no other after that. The seventh is a conclusion, just like the third is a conclusion, as it were. Okay. So, any comments on this verse 14? Brother David.
In Revelation 8:13, we had the three woes mentioned, which kind of gives us, a little bit of insight into it. And, just the idea that, the first four, messengers were mostly having to do with the earth. And what I think of as what we brought out, and this may not be a correct idea, but it seems to me we have these, going back and forth, for these birth pangs. And, so that the people have to make, choices, when these, woes come. And part of the actual fabric of, the culture of our civilization is being ripped up when these three come, because they try to right themselves again, but it's almost like, the flood of waters. Where people know what's going on. This truth revelation, the people know, and it kind of works against this hierarchy and brings about this final test, which is actually occurs in the seventh trumpet. Over.
Oh, very good. We appreciate that. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
If it helps a little bit, if you want to locate the woes in Revelation, you just remember that the three woes are talked about, like Brother David brought out in 8:13. Then the next three chapters each has a woe in it. 9, 12, 11, or I'm skipping 10, I'm sorry. 11, 14, and 12, 12. So in a way, if you keep it from, in your mind from, Revelations 8 through 12, you'll find all three woes in those middle chapters, if it helps. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Ruth.
I guess I'm off the topic a little bit, but I was thinking of that verse 14, the third woe cometh quickly, that the verse 13 brings you really past 1799, and then the next one, the third woe, starts in 1874, so it is really quickly when it comes to history and Revelation. Over.
Yes, for sure. That 1800s were packed with monumental events of all sorts. But very good. Thank you. Brother Adi, last comment.
And so it's interesting that these woes are sequential, that the second woe has to pass before the third woe is coming. So it's the way God ordered it. Whereas it could have happened that it doesn't happen randomly, that one overlaps the other one, because that would have been a mess in God's plan. But they are sequential, and they're, one has to pass before the other one comes. Over.
Nope, very good. Appreciate that. And so true. So very true. We got a little hint of that when we studied in Revelation 6, that sixth seal that we read about together, that then the Lord had to restrain the four winds from blowing. He restrained the French Revolution from sweeping over the rest of Europe, because it would have been premature. He's saving the destruction of the rest of the city, the whole city, to take place during the seventh trumpet. So, couldn't happen in the sixth trumpet. The Lord has this ordered, just like Brother Adi was commenting. Okay, dear brother, we'll close here. We'll pick up with chapter 11, verse 15 next week, Lord willing, and the